Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
What makes a Buddhist monk? This is the motivating question for Thomas Borchert, as he explores the social and educational formation of Buddhists from Southwest China. Borchert introduces his readers to the Dai ethnic minority community through vivid accounts of their local temples, village schools, and transnational connections in his new book, Educating Monks, Minority Buddhism on China's Southwest Border. He carefully draws out the social and political constraints in which Dai Buddhists must navigate, including both Chinese government policies on religion and how Buddhists interact with their co-religionists regionally and abroad. Educating Monks offers comparative multi-sided ethnography of Theravada Buddhism in the post-Mao period. In our conversation, we discussed how the monastic community is organized, curricular education, the monk's career, the Chinese Buddhist Association, transnational interactions and training, how Buddhism is governed in the modern Chinese state, and how the category religion is deployed in China. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Religion. And now, my conversation with Thomas Borchert about Educating Monks, Minority Buddhism on China's Southwest Border, published by University of Hawaii Press in 2017. Welcome, Tom. Thanks for joining us on New Books in Religion. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thank you for having me here today.
Yeah, I'm glad we were able to talk about this wonderful book, Educating Monks. I, as somebody who has spent some time in this area in China, was excited to hear about communities that I wasn't really working on. But I want to know a little bit about what brought you to the study of religion in general, what brought you to the study of Buddhism. Who might be some important mentors of yours or moments in your kind of intellectual career that steered you in the direction you went?
Yeah, so I there are a couple different moments that I think directed me in how I've ended up here at this particular point in time and working on this group of people in Southwest China. When I was 15, I went to Japan to visit my older brother who was living there, and we traveled. I traveled around with my older sister and my older brother, and was just fascinated by what I saw in both Japan, but also we went to Thailand, where I, you know, again, I'm a kid from Cleveland, and was just kind of shocked by all the things that were going on there. So when I got to college, I studied Chinese because I went to Swarthmore College and they didn't offer Japanese at the time. And I studied with a guy named Don Swearer, who is a scholar of Buddhism in Thailand. And he really encouraged me after I graduated from college to go to visit both this place called Sipsong Bana in Southwest China, because he knew I'd studied Chinese, but also that it was a place that was part of China But it also had a bunch of folks who were practicing Theravada Buddhism, and I'd studied Theravada Buddhism with him in college. This kind of crystallized though at a couple of different moments in the couple of years after I graduated. Don was working doing research in Chiang Mai at the time, and I had asked him if there were any opportunities to work in Chiang Mai or in Bangkok that he knew about, and he found me a job teaching English to novice monks at a monastic high school in Chiang Mai. This is in the early 90s. So I spent about 6 months doing that. And when I first got there, I had this like overwhelming sense of awe, like, oh my gosh, these are novices. They're on this religious quest to find, you know, something. I was living in a monastery at the time, cause I could live there for free, in exchange for teaching English at the monastery. And so I'm like living in this romantic world of Northern Thailand. And one day these novices come up to me after class and they say, you know, Mr. Tom, can we talk with you about something? And I say, of course. And here I'm expecting some interesting, rich conversation about their religious life. And they're like, Mr. Tom, do you know the song I Swear by All for One? And I'm like, why, no, I've never heard this song, I Swear by All for One. And they start breaking into, you know, two or three part harmony, singing this song to me. And I'm sitting there going, wait a second, these guys aren't really concerned with a spiritual life. They're concerned with pop culture. and it kind of triggered me to thinking that the way I had been thinking about and I don't know, treating religion and religious communities wasn't that it was wrong. It wasn't that Buddhist monks weren't interested in, you know, Buddhism, but that wasn't all they were interested in. And most of them lived, you know, complicated lives that had nothing to do with Buddhism. A little bit after that, I was living in Thailand, but I needed a new visa. So I flew up to China, where they had a consulate, and I flew down to Sipsong Pana I took a bus down to Sipsong Pana at the time. There was no airport in the region, and you could only get there by going from Kunming, which is the capital of Yunnan province, down to Jinghong by bus, which took about 20 hours through mountains, and so it felt very isolated and far away from everything. So I spent a couple days there while I was getting my visa, and I wandered around and went to temples, and this was the same time I was teaching novice monks English at a monastic high school in Thailand. And the thing I kept running into were all these novices, you know, and so novices, as you probably know, are young men who are usually between the age of, like, I don't know, 9 or 10 and 20, who have left home. They've ordained as a monk, but they're not responsible for following all the precepts that fully ordained monks are. So, you know, these are kids for the most part. And I kept encountering kids who were not in school. They weren't in public school. They were just living in monasteries. They would say, I'd ask them why they weren't in school, you know, why they weren't in the public school. And they'd say, well, that's stupid because we're novices. We don't have to be in school. And I said, where are the monks? And well, the monks around here. And so we'd have these long conversations about what they were doing. And I started to think that this was some kind of ethnic resistance to being Chinese. And in part, this is one of the roles that Buddhism has in this region. But I thought that trying to figure out why these young men were novice monks was really what, you know, and not normal, and not normal lay kids, why they weren't in the regular school, why they decided to become novices, what they hoped to do with that, was really what kind of pushed me to going to grad school. It seemed at that point there was a story that I thought was worth telling that I didn't see anyone else telling. So after that, I went to grad school and got a job.
Now, a lot of this work, I think, was happening around the time of grad school. And then I know you made a couple return trips. But can you talk a little bit about how this book kind of started to coalesce around certain ideas or topics? I know you're doing work there and you're experiencing life in southwestern China. But when did you really kind of get a grasp of kind of this these multiple layers of monk education and state and religious group kind of interaction? When did these themes start to kind of pull together for you?
It becomes hard to know, like, the moment when something crystallizes, because my first real research trip to Sipsong Banao was in probably 98, and my most recent trip that affected this this book in some ways was in 2011. I think the 1990s there was a lot of discussion that was going on in the broader academic community, both about nationalism and the effect of nationalism that had to do with the collapse of Yugoslavia and the end of the Cold War. And at the same time, there was a lot of discussion about resistance and domination and the work of, say, Jim Scott in thinking about how it is that subaltern communities deal with the state. And so when I first started doing research on Sipsong Banao, I was thinking about it primarily in terms of nationalism, national identity, the way in which religion gets articulated in China. And it also, I mean, the other, there are a couple other things that are going on in China at the same time. The late 1990s and the early aughts is a period when it becomes possible to do much more substantial ethnographic research, particularly ethnographic research on religion, outside of something like Beijing, outside of the major, you know, urban areas. And it's also a period in which scholars are really beginning to think about the way that ethnic minorities are living in the context of contemporary China. Again, you know, one of the important kind of basic facts around the work that I've done in Sipsong Banao is the fact that China is a multi-nationality state, a multi-ethnic state, where there are some 55 different ethnic minorities that are recognized by the national government, and while the Han are the vast majority of the population, there are still, I don't know if it's like 10 to 15% of the population are ethnic minorities, then we're talking about 150 million people. And the vast majority of these people are situated around the borders of China, as are the Daizu, the folks that I've worked with the most. So within China, national minorities become a site for thinking about the nation, a site for thinking about nationalism, and also a site for national security, which is certainly what we've seen going on in the last couple of years with the way in which the Chinese state, the Chinese government has put many ethnic, and many ethnic Muslims, the Uyghurs, in what are basically concentration camps, re-education camps in the Northwest. The Daizu are not that politically sensitive. They've had generally a positive relationship with the Chinese government as a group. It is not a sensitive border in the way that the Northwest has been. But that becomes, for me, an interesting thing to think about is why it is that this group hasn't had problems with the Chinese government in the way that the Uyghurs, for example, have. So I came in thinking about nationalism and ethnic minorities, and then just at the point in which I'm really beginning to start research on the Daizu. In 1999, the Falun crisis, the Falun Gong crisis erupts in China, and part of what that does is that it creates this context whereby the category of religion becomes an important political object, an important political subject. So we've got nationalism on the one hand, we've got the problem of religion, we've got and world religion discourse, which is a part of this. And then a couple times when I was in Thailand, for example, on my way up to Siptong Pana, I would go to temples, either in Bangkok or Chiang Mai, and I would encounter Dai monks, Dai Le monks, Daizu monks in Bangkok and in Thailand, and I'd ask them why they'd come down there, and they'd tell me they came down for an education. So all of a sudden, in addition to the kind of problem of nationalism, we then and minorities within the nation state, we also and then the religion, the problem of religion in China. What kept happening to me is I kept encountering the problem of the transnational in the life of these monks. And so this, instead of it becoming a book about kind of nationalism and governance of monks within a particular national context, I had to begin to think about the way in which monks move as well as monks being located in a particular place.
Yeah, and this, I think, is one of the really interesting things about the book is this kind of, I guess what we call it, translocal kind of ethnography that you do, where you trace these networks. And, I don't know a ton about the scholarship on Chinese Buddhism, but I know enough to know that this is kind of a unique approach to kind of a lot of the work that's being done on modern Chinese Buddhism. Before you get to these kind of networked relationships, you really provide a great snapshot of local Buddhism, what I think you call village Buddhism. Mm. So could you kind of just lay out what's going on in this kind of localized Buddhism in the post-Mao period? What is a monk's career look like? How is the monastic community organized in this kind of local domain?
Sure. So Sipsong Pana is a region that shares a lot of similarities with northern Thailand and the Shan states in Myanmar. And what I mean by that is that the Buddhism in the region has tended to be very closely embedded in society. They practice temporary ordination. So what that means is that a young man might ordain as a novice or as a fully ordained monk for a short period of time, and then disrobe, become a lay person again without any difficulties, without any social consequences. Or he could remain in robes for his entire life. For most young men, up until the Cultural Revolution in this region, so Cultural Revolution 1966 to 1976, more or less, for most young men, what this meant was that ordaining as a novice or as a monk was an important part of becoming a fully recognized member of society. And so a lot of people have said to me over the years that if you were a Dai male prior to 1965, if you wanted to get married, you actually had to become a monk first. So from this we see that it's very much a part of what society, the way that society has perpetuates itself over time. In the post-cultural revolutionary era, so we're really talking 1980 until the present, the relationship between being a Dai man and being a monk, that relationship is severed to a certain extent. That is to say, it is no longer a requisite of being a well-recognized Dai male that they ordain. But at least for the first 25 years of the reform era, and so maybe up until a decade and a half ago, it remains really common for most boys to ordain as novices. Not required, but extremely common. And so for most of them, what this means is that they're learning how to read the local script. The local script is very similar to Northern Thai. They're learning how to chant Pali. They may be learning some protective rituals. And depending on the temple that they live in and the abbot of the temple, they learn much. They may end up learning a whole lot more. And so they do this. They're in robes, living in the temple for a couple of years, and then most of them will disrobe. One of the things that's also going on, and I talk about this a little bit later in the book, when I'm talking about education more specifically, is that you've got these pressures from the Chinese state and just the economic development going on in China that have an impact on the way that Buddhism is situated into Dai society. So historically, again, pre-1965, the institution of the monastic institution was fairly decentralized. There was a king, and there were some royal monks, but there's a fairly decentralized aspect to life. You know, each kind of village center has its own senior monk, and those senior monks interact largely with the senior monks of the rest of the region. And most people stay fairly locally. One of the things that happens in the post-cultural revolutionary period is that the Buddhist Association is established in Sipsongpana, a local office, and the Buddhist Association is a quasi-governmental organization that is established by Buddhists in order to serve as a mediator and as a link between the Chinese government and Buddhists. So they are responsible for making sure that Buddhists, Buddhist monks, Buddhist nuns understand what the rules are. They're also supposed to, you know, with the regulations and rules that the government is promulgating are. They also advocate on behalf of Buddhists, so they may be running specific institutions. You know, they may be responsible for managing temples in various Buddhist sites across the country. And in Sipsongpana, it's the establishment of the Buddhist Association has meant ultimately that there has been the development of a more centralized institution that manages monks and temples in the region than had existed prior to 1965. You know, to go back to your original question, your earlier question about what the kind of career of a monk might look like, there seem to be two different in the current moment. There seem to be two different kinds of career paths for monks. A bunch of them will, one of these paths is that a young man will ordain. He'll learn how to be a monk. He'll learn how to chant and to read in Dai Le, and then he will disrobe and either be a peasant, you know, he'll work as a rice farmer or a vegetable worker or something like that, or maybe a trader around the region. The other pathway is that they will tend to go into a higher level of monastic education. So they'll attend a monastic high school, and that then opens up other doors for them in terms of educational opportunities, which again I talk about later in the book. And then that opens up to them a variety of other opportunities, either as a professional monk or as a monk who's received a more substantial education. But the thing that I really try to do, at least in the first part of this book, in the chapter one, Local Monks in Sipsongpana, is to emphasize the fact that on the one hand, you've got these kind of long-standing kind of practices of ordination and Buddhism within village life. And yet at the same time, there's a long-term process of change that's going on, particularly in the post, you know, in the reform era from 1980 onward, as Sipsongpana as a region becomes more tightly integrated into the Chinese political economy. So that in a sense, China, or the idea of China or Chinese governance, is kind of increasingly pressing on what were relatively longstanding relationships and ways of organizing society.
The government or the state, kind of, you talked a little bit about this in terms of their role in the Chinese Buddhist Association, but I think many listeners that maybe are not familiar with kind of how religion works in China would, and I know you kind of deal with this in interesting ways in the book and in your work since the book. Maybe tell us a little bit about discourses, policies related to the category religion. How does your work here in the book kind of fit into that conversation in terms of this kind of relationship between local Buddhist, the state, governance, and the kind of the role of religion here?
Yeah. So one of the things I mentioned earlier, the kind of the Falun Gong crisis, and I think this is, so this is around the year 2000, and I think this is an interesting moment in kind of current, you know, recent Chinese history, because if we look at the history of the reform era, part of what's going on in the reform era is the central government is trying to figure out how to deal with religion as a whole. You know, how to deal with religious actors, how to deal with minority religious actors, because they found that in the Cultural Revolution, there was this strong attempt to just abolish religion from society, and it didn't work. So in the early 1980s, late 1970s, early 1980s, the government finds itself in this position where they want to shift from a policy of abolishing religion to a policy of regulating and managing religion. And the Falun Gong crisis, and I'll you know explain that in a second. The Falun Gong crisis becomes an interesting moment because it fractures the way in which the Chinese government has sought to try to regulate and manage religion. There are I think over this kind of 40-year period, there are two different aspects to the management and the regulation of religion that I think are important. One of the aspects is that the government engages in what we might think of as a world religions discourse. They seek to define religion and explain what kind of religion is okay and what kinds of maybe religiosity are not okay. So in the 1980s and in the 1990s, this is articulated most clearly in terms of two categories that we'll call normal religion and feudal superstition. And so normal religion are things that include the five religions that the Chinese government recognizes, which are Buddhism and Taoism, Christianity, Islam, and Catholicism. You know, the Chinese government splits up Protestant forms of Christianity and Catholicism into two separate groups, two separate religions, as it were. And so it likes, you know, what kind of makes these phenomena religions in the eyes of the Chinese state, normal religions, is that they're old, they're complicated, they are mass-based, and by complicated, I mean they have like a rich textual and philosophical history, things like this. What counts as feudal superstition tend to be practices which are individually focused, which include sorcery of various sorts or divination, a lot of what we think of as popular Chinese religion, actually. But in a lot of ways, it seems to me that what is important about, or where the distinction really lies, is it ends up being kind of an empty signifier for the things that the Chinese government feels concerned about, wants to control or to regulate. The idea about religion here, religion and feudal superstition, and then in after the crisis of the Falun Gong, the addition to these two categories of evil cults, so we have religion, feudal superstition, and evil cults, is that it establishes or it uses a discourse about religion to give the government the flexibility to engage in ideological warfare against religious phenomena that it feels uncomfortable with. So the category of evil cults or feudal superstition can be deployed against groups that it doesn't like. So we've got, on the one hand, we've got this kind of discursive ideological way of managing and regulating religion. And on the other hand, you've got a set of institutional structures that are established to regulate religious actors as religious actors. So they include, on the one hand, organizations like the Buddhist Association, which has a national, you know, both national offices, but also local offices. And then you've got the religious affairs bureaus, which has gone by a variety of different names over the years. During most of this millennium, it's been run by the State Administration for Religious Affairs, though that was just abolished or dissolved in the last year, and folded into the United Front Work Department. But this kind of the religious affairs bureaus were the government workers, the party members, the state's formal apparatus and institutional structures for managing and interacting with religious actors. Because one of the things that is also important is that there is a real concern by the Chinese government, kind of in the long and medium durée, to keep the party members divorced from religion. They don't want party members to be entangled with religious communities, because religion is an alternative source of loyalty. And this is, you know, which is one of the reasons why the Chinese government has long tried to keep also, they're Marxist and they don't like religion that way, but it's this kind of alternative source of loyalty that presents them with a real challenge. So you've got these kind of these discursive tools for managing religion and institutional tools for managing religion. And one of the things that I talk about is that these have consequences for the ways in which the Dai Le monks can live their lives, and I in the book I give this example of a group of Han men who come down to Sipsong Bana and set themselves up as monks who tell fortunes. This would be, you know, in Thailand, something like this would be illegal, because it's illegal to impersonate a monk. but not in China. So the monks that I work with in the Buddhist Association ended up having this challenge because they had these guys who were imitating monks and impersonating monks and ripping off tourists as they were fortune tellers. And they, the monks, didn't have the tools to try to get rid of them. They needed the government. They needed the government's help to arrest these monks. And they invoked, you know, in a lot of ways, they invoked the language that the government uses of feudal superstition and things like this to try to get the government to arrest these monks. In the end, the government arrested these monks primarily for reasons that followed the government's interests. They weren't concerned with the monks, with the monks' interests. But they were concerned that these false monks were ripping off tourists, and the economy of Sipsong Thana relies heavily on tourists. So one of the conclusions that I draw from this is you know what I've been implying up to this point, which is that there is a very strong world religions discourse within China, and in some ways this helps people like the monks of Sipsong Thana because it's given them the opportunities to rebuild their sangha, to rebuild their monastic institution, but it is a set of discursive tools that the government has established for its own purposes, and so these monks find themselves in a position where they have it's not that they have no tools, but they're in a very much a subaltern position in terms of managing their religious lives in relation to the state.
Now, through your ethnography, you kind of expand from the local scene, and you kind of follow monks in a way into to larger and larger schools, both within the region and then kind of transnationally. Can you kind of walk us through what some of those settings look like, what's happening in those places, what are some of the curricular goals for monks at a kind of higher level of education? What was your experience in these kind of places?
Well, so I think they're in thinking about that, I think it's worth also kind of thinking about the how it is that monks move in the first place. And the thing that I started with, again, to go back to this idea of local monks of Sipsong Thana, is that most ethnographies of Theravada monks have tended to be fairly village-based. And they have tended to not pay attention to the degree to which monks move either in the current moment or historically. And part of what I encountered is that monks, the monks of Sipsong Thana at least, were moving a good deal. They were moving around across villages a boy grows up in a village that doesn't really have any novices, so he might go to the neighboring village to get an education. The monks of Sipsong Thana also established a monastic high school in Jinghong, the capital of the region, and so novices were traveling from their regional villages to the capital for an education. And then when they finished in that situation, you know, when they finished at that monastic high school, the monks at the monastic high school in Jinghong at Wat Bajaya would often send monks and novices to monastic schools around to a variety of different places, to the monastic schools of China. So they were sending Theravada monks from Sipsongpanna to Mahayana Foshueyuan or Buddhist institutes, where they might get something that resembled a junior college education. But they also sent them from Sipsongpanna down to Thailand, where they would go either into a Naktam course, which would give them an education, like a 3-year education as a monk in Thailand, or they would also learn Pali in Thailand, and very occasionally they would send monks to even further away to a place like Singapore. So in fact, I start the book with this encounter that I had in Singapore in 2010, where I was doing I had a fellowship at the Institute for Southeast Asian Studies, focused on Buddhist networks in Asia. And in 2008 or 2009, there was a new school that was opened up in Singapore, the Buddhist College of Singapore. And the Buddhist College of Singapore, it was mainly established in order to foster the training of Chinese monks in Mahayana Buddhism, but through an English language medium. And so I visited the Buddhist College of Singapore, and most of the monks, most of the students at the Buddhist College of Singapore are from the People's Republic of China. So I visited there a couple of times, and I was asked to give a lecture to the students, who are all monks, about something. And so I decided to give them, to talk to them about Sipsongpanna. And I knew that most of the students were from China. So I said, I assume all of you know who the Daizu of Sipsongpanna are. Using the Chinese terms. And all of them pointed to a particular monk. And I'm like, oh, why are you doing that? And it turned out that he was actually from Sipsongpanna. And so, I was in this kind of weird position where the white American scholar is giving a lecture to the Chinese monk about his own region. So, in other words, part of what happens and that I talk about in the book is that education becomes a really important vector for enabling monks to travel regionally, nationally, and transnationally, and they end up. They end up in a variety of different institutions, which have a variety of agendas for what it means and what they want a monk to be. So, in thinking about this, we need to think about kind of three different levels of agendas. You asked what kind of monks these schools are trying to produce. I think we need to ask three different questions. What is it that the young men are trying to get out of this? What is it that the Sangha of Sipsongpanna is trying to get out of this? Because it's the Sangha of Sipsongpanna, the senior monks of the region, that are sending these young men to places around China and around Asia. And then what are the institutions trying to get out of it? In terms of the first, most of these young men are simply seeking more opportunities for study. They most of them feel that they have a strong responsibility to their community to become better educated, and they see Buddhist education as a way of attaining that. The Sangha of Sipsongpana, the senior monks of the region, are really engaged, it seems to me, in this project of fostering that sense of responsibility in the novice monks. But they're also concerned with maintaining Buddhism, and they see maintaining Buddhism in the region, with kind of the goods that they see Buddhism as threatened by economic development, by a strong Chinese identity as opposed to a Dai Le identity. And they see the education system of the region as being against Buddhism and not very good. So when they're sending their young men to education places, to educational institutions in Sipsongpana, in China, in Thailand, and elsewhere, what they're really trying to do, it seems to me, is develop human capital in order to maintain the Sangha of Sipsongpana. They want to create a whole series of smart, well-educated men, some of whom are monks, some of whom are not monks, but all of whom feel a responsibility to Buddhism in the region. And then these, I guess we might call them transnational monastic institutes, are really very diverse in their agendas. Some of them are national institutions, so and should be seen as such. And some of them have a much broader agenda. The Fuoshuiyuan, the Buddhist Institutes of China, end up, it seems to me, having a very strong having to foster in monks this ideology of Aiguo, Aijia, which means loving the country, literally means love country, love religion. But what it seems to me is being about is about a concern that comes from the state about the need to develop patriotic forms of Buddhism that are embedded in and subservient to notions of Chinese nationalism. So the young men of Sipsongpana are exposed to this. They're also exposed at the same time to some of the monastic schools of Thailand, which have that same kind of agenda of developing a Buddhism which is subservient to Thailand or deeply tied into Thai forms of nationalism. But at the same time, what you've also got going on in Thailand is this interesting effort on the part of some of the Buddhist universities, in particular, like Mahachula Longkorn Buddhist University, to foster the notion that Mahachula Longkorn Buddhist University is actually the center of the Buddhist world. So it becomes kind of like a modern day Nalanda University that Buddhist monks from all over the world can come and study there. So one of the interesting things this does is that looked at in total, we see these novices become part of multiple different kinds of Buddhist worlds, or as Buddhist ethnoscapes, where they're imagining themselves as local actors. They're imagining themselves as part of national forms of Buddhism, but they're also imagining themselves as part of translocal forms of Buddhism. And the, you know, in a sense, I open and close the book with the question of what is it that makes a Buddhist monk? You know, how is a Buddhist monk produced? And in some ways, there's not a a single answer, right? You know, some books or some articles that people write have this clear kind of question and an articulated answer. This book opens up with a series of layers, and I spend much of the time disentangling the layers. So in some ways, what I've done in the book is not to provide an answer of what is it that makes a Buddhist monk, but to provide, I hope that this complexifying layers of, there are a lot of different things that make a Buddhist monk, and we have to pay attention to them in their kind of their local and their personal answers to what that is. But there are these constant ways in which national politics and transnational politics also press upon the choices that these young men make and the opportunities that are available to them. And so, you know, as I said, there's not a single answer, but there are lots of different answers about how the contemporary Sangha is coming into being, but that we need to pay attention to all of those different layers.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful book, Tom, and I think both people, of course, that are working on religion in China will benefit from it, but I think those that aren't even working on Buddhism or China should pick it up that are in the study of religion. I think it makes some interesting contributions, so I hope they'll take a look.
Me too.
Yeah. Before I let you go, can you tell us a little bit about some of the stuff you're working on now?
Yeah, the so one of the things that I have found interesting about the Dai Le is the way in which they are they have a complicated citizenship status, which is to say they are political citizens of China, but in many ways they are cultural citizens of the greater Thai world, and in particular of Thailand. And so I started to, in as I was finishing this work, I was also beginning to think about what it means for monks to be political actors and to be political agents. We often think about monks, if we think about monks, we tend to think about them as people who are outside of the world in you know, as otherworldly ascetics to in the kind of old Weberian terms. But monks are people, and they're often citizens. And so that means that, you know, for the Dai Le, as I was working with them and I would encounter them in Thailand, I would ask them, you know, how do you cross borders? Because, you know, I can't cross the border from Myanmar or Laos into China without a visa. Did they have passports? What were the regulations that governed them? Were they the same as other citizens, or were they different? And, you know, the answer, it turns out, is that they are a little bit different from other citizens of China, but what the salient distinction is not the fact that they are monks, but the fact that they're ethnic minorities. And so they could cross overland without a passport. These kinds of questions got me thinking about, as I said, the question of what it means for a monk to be both a religious actor and a citizen at the same time. And so for the last 4 or 5 years, I have been doing research specifically on Thai monks as citizens. One of the interesting things about Thai monks is that although they have a very high status in society, they are disenfranchised. They are precluded from voting in the many different constitutions that Thailand has had since 1932, which means that they are both really valued, but also in some ways exceptional to and outside of society. And so I've been since 2014, really, I've been in two or three different research trips. I've been interviewing monks in Bangkok and in Chiang Mai about their attitudes towards their political status, whether they agree with it, whether they think that monks should be allowed to vote, things like this. The other thing that I've been kind of encountering at the same time, which has become a part of this project, is questions of Islamophobia among Thai monks. We become pretty unfortunately we've become aware of the degree to which discourses and kind of practices of Islamophobia have become widespread among the monks of Myanmar and Sri Lanka. But this hasn't really been a big issue in Thailand. But one of the things, and so like in my first work on this in 2014, I would ask monks, which is right about the same time that the crisis with the Rohingya in Myanmar was really becoming more widely known internationally. I would ask monks in Bangkok what they thought about Muslims. And all of the monks that I would talk to were basically, well, you know, they're our neighbors, you know, those Muslims over there, they're fine. We don't, you know, there are other places where Muslims are a problem, but in Thailand, they're just Thais. But in the last few trips that I've taken to Thailand in 2017 and 2018, I've encountered far more statements that resemble the kind of Islamophobic statements that one hears out of Myanmar, the kinds of kind of demographic anxieties that one hears that Muslims are trying to take over the country, that they're a threat to Buddhism. And these, of course, are patently absurd. Roughly 90% of the Thai population it calls itself Buddhist. There's no way that Buddhism is going to disappear in many lifetimes from Thailand. So the emergence of this discourse is of course troubling, but it's also I think really interesting to explore. So I hope to go back to Chiang Mai, where I've encountered far more of this Islamophobic discourse, and begin to interrogate and interview monks about how Islam fits into the national ideology and the way that Islam and Buddhism fit. Because I think if we begin to understand how Thai monks are how they see Islam, we can begin to think about other ways in which to avoid the kinds of conflicts and crisis we've had we've seen in Myanmar in the last couple of years.
Well, Tom, you got a lot of work to do, it sounds like.
Yes.
Well, thanks for taking the time to talk about this wonderful book, and I wish you luck on all these great projects.
Thank you very much, Christian.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Religion. That was my conversation with Thomas Borchert about educating monks, minority Buddhism on China's southwest border, published with University of Hawaii Press in 2017.